And this week on Language Lab, our regular Thursday conversation about conversations, we discuss language evolution. How did language start and where is it going? Here to chat with us is Dr. Celeste Rodriguez-Luro, Chair of Linguistics and Director of Language Lab at UWA and winner of all sorts of fancy things. How are you, Celeste?
How are you? Lovely to speak with you today.
Tell us about winning prizes.
I know. I am so excited. Thank you to everyone and anyone who nominated Language Lab for an award by the Australian Linguistic Society, an award that has a really wonderful name. It's the Talkly Award. You were saying this is a conversation about conversation. So, you know, talking is what we do, what we love doing on radio and what we love doing in linguistics, at least some of us, definitely me. And so, yeah, I was really lucky to be awarded a Talkly Award for Language Lab, which recognises not only the work that I do, but also the work of our wonderful interns so far, Linda, Lydia, and Grace more recently, mm-hmm. Billy at the beginning of the year, and of course the work of Amanda Hamilton, who is with you once a month.
Yeah.
So we're very, very pleased, and this award really recognises the work that linguists do on the media to bring awareness to language and communication. So wonderful, wonderful.
Well, congratulations. And we shall move to our very small question, which is, how did language start? That's a small question, right?
It's a simple question. It's a tiny detail of our evolution as a human species. So this is a huge, huge question. It's a wonderful question. And I think a lot of us are really kind of truly curious about, how did language start? Now, the short of it is that no one is entirely sure how language came about, but there are different theories about it. And the nice thing about this is that there are multiple fields of study that come into play when it comes to the question of how did language begin. So, of course, we've got linguistics, which, as our listeners know really well, is a scientific study of language. But then again, you need to ask questions around history, archaeology, biology, anthropology, and so on. The reason this is the case is that many people who investigate human history and the origins of language believe that language is the product of social cohesion. So people coming together, and with the introduction of a particular social order and roles and rituals in human civilization, we hypothesize that language then arose.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's really interesting. A lot of scientists believe that words could have initially originated from emotional expressions and gestures, sort of like pre-linguistically, there were these expressions and gestures and sort of language-like behavior that began to shape language. And some of the evidence of this comes from what we can see monkeys do.
So right.
This is where monkeys come into play, right? Because monkeys, we are related to monkeys, and some of what they do may may be a parallel to what we do as well. So when we look at the cognitive ability of monkeys, especially around grabbing and how they interact with this idea of moving the body to grab something, that also kind of reflects a cognitive ability for language, suggesting that maybe the two phenomena could have originated from the same place. The interesting thing as well with human language is that we have very unique and incredible vocal characteristics, and some animals have them too, but, you know, to be able to produce spoken language, we're not talking about sign language, for spoken language, we need a whole range of things to be in place, right? We need the right kind of tongue. It needs to be the right size. You need a palate, and the palate has, like, both a soft sort of area and a harder area. If you feel your palate, you'll realize that's the case. We've got teeth. All sorts of areas within sort of the alveolar region, like behind the upper front teeth, that we can use to produce sound. We've got our throats and our lungs, of course, and our vocal cords and so on. We also have our hands and our face. All of that together allows us to produce language as we know it. But the main thing is that we've got a physiology that allows us to produce sound, and not only like any sound randomly, but we're able to produce sounds in a very predictable order so that we can understand one another. The other really interesting thing, and you know, this is such a long answer because it's a big question.
Is
that biologists have suggested that language could have begun when our ancestors started to walk on two legs. So when our ancestors began to walk on two legs, what happened is that our hands were suddenly freed up. And the moment you've got free hands, you can use them for communication. And then the use of gesture likely became more arbitrary, which means, you know, gestures no longer mean exactly what they're representing. And then they become conventionalized, meaning if I see a gesture that's not really kind of like the shape of the actual thing that I see in the world, and we all understand that gesture to mean that thing that does not look like the actual thing in the world, then you're talking about conventionalized behavior, and that is literally what language is, right? It's conventional. And so potentially then that's another avenue for language to have grown the way it did.
My mind is spinning, Celeste. I'm thinking about lots of things, including when you were talking about gestures, and I'm doing it now, and stereotypes as I was growing up that, like, for instance, Italian people wave their hands around. Where do those sorts of stereotypes come with the cultural codifying of language groups?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So, look, Italian people do use a lot of gesture. There's no, you know, the reason there's a, you know, potentially, I guess what you don't want to do is to kind of like essentialize and say, oh, you're Italian, hence you'll gesture a lot. You know, you don't want to do that. But it is true that in some cultures, people tend to gesture more. And those are just cultural differences, you know, to do with your own private individual space, how important that is, whether you gesturing, you know, how much room you use to produce that gesture. Are you kind of like entering someone else's physical space? Does that matter? I mean, for an Anglo-Celtic person, that will matter, especially for Anglo people, because of that individual space that people really kind of hold very sacred and close to their heart. For other, in other cultures, it's quite okay to actually tap people on their shoulder, to have way more physical contact, and to gesture in a way that you're almost like inviting that contact from the other person. So it really depends on, once again, convention, right? If you go to Italy and live in Italy for long enough, eventually you'll be gesturing. And it's not just Italy. I mean, it could be said of many cultures.
No, that was just my example.
Just an example, right? Mm. So, but what I'm saying is, if you spend long enough in Italy or any country where gesture is used frequently and kind of in a very meaningful way, you'll find yourself doing it too, potentially. But I think the really interesting use of gesture is what you were just referring to, that we're both on the phone right now. I don't know that listeners know this, but I'm on the phone, and all I do is gesture. But I'm on my own. I'm not gesturing to anyone. So why do we do it? And the reason we do it is that gesture just helps you put together a string of thought in a way that would make sense to the other person. Cognitively, it kind of, you know, it's almost like a symphony, and gesture is sort of like directing that symphony that you're producing so that you know that you're like on the right track. It can also be very interesting for forensic uses, as we've mentioned before in Language Lab. If someone is lying, are those gestures like in line with what they're saying, or are they delayed? Slightly delayed, or is there a lack of gesture making it look like someone is not being truthful? So gesture is actually, I would say, almost like an authenticity gap, you know, just allows you to figure out whether someone is being authentic in what they're saying. So never ever on Language Lab have we said, or will we say, that the only thing that matters is spoken language or the sound. That's only a tiny, tiny little piece of the puzzle. Language is multifaceted and extremely complex.
I'm just thinking of when language was the word first used to describe language. Getting very meta this morning, Celeste. How has English changed over time?
Yeah, gosh, it's changed so much, and it's just changing all the time. I'm just trying to remember, I was asking, so I'll just bring this up quickly because it could be of interest to some of our listeners, that the Oxford English Dictionary's most popular word for 2023, given that we're wrapping up 23, is riz, riz, which comes from charisma. And so I was like, okay, riz, a noun meaning, you know, the ability to bring people in, potentially the ability to kind of gain, you know, attract people romantically and so on. And so I said, okay, this is interesting. And I asked my son, who is 9, I said, do you know this word? And he said, of course I do. And that's when you say, that's when you, number one, feel old. And number two, think, you know what? Yes, of course, because English and any other language is changing all the time.
Yeah.
So English has been changing forever. It may look like it's not changing, especially because we see kind of like dictionaries and books and we think, okay, that's it, that's the English language. And the reality is that, as you know, dictionaries have to be updated constantly to be able to, you know, incorporate new usage. Even if we think about English, how it was used 100 years ago, we can notice a lot of differences. Of course, a lot of innovation has come through with technology, as we know, and also with, like, a trend to use nouns as verbs, so things like I'll text you or I'll email you, you know, with those words, text and email started off as nouns. And also, you know, if anyone ever reads, say, Shakespeare poems, you know, there's a wonderful one where the person is being compared to a summer day, and that comparison is being done using the pronoun thou rather than the pronoun you, and that's another example of how radically the pronominal system, the system of pronouns, has changed. If you look back at how English was being used back in the days of Shakespeare, and so on. The other thing to remember is that English, as the language of the empire, as an imperial language that has really wiped out a lot of indigenous knowledge and language and culture, it's also been indigenized. Something else we've touched on Language Lab, right? So English has changed due to its geographic expansion, colonization, trade, migration, and globalization, and so on. And so you get all of these indigenized varieties of English that are not like standardized Australian English, although they may sound like they are like standardized English, but they're not. And that's really important for us to remember as well, that we've got all this variability going around. Just to give you an example with Australian Aboriginal English, if you hear the word granny, you may think, well, that's just a granny, you know, a grandmother. But in reality, granny in Aboriginal English is used both ways. It's a kinship term to refer both to your grandmother but also to your grandchildren. And so when you're in a different culture, you'll see that a lot of the English terms will be indigenized, will be made to suit or will change to suit that different culture. And so that's another aspect of change in English to keep in mind.
And you were talking about the language of a cohesion of peoples, and I think of when we use language to separate ourselves from the mainstream in some ways, like Pidgin English, which, you know, lots of kids have tried over time, or Polari, where you have a coded language that is not, I'm using my gestures here now, Celeste, inverted commas, it's not, you know, real or formal, but still communicates within members of a group.
Yeah, that's such an excellent question. Thank you. I think, you know, something to remember is that any language, any variety, let me rephrase this, any variety that we use to communicate, spoken, signed, and so on, is a linguistic variety, also known in linguistics as a dialect. I'm not using dialect here because I know that for lay people, dialect is like a bad word, not the real language. So linguistic varieties. We all use linguistic varieties. Mm-hmm. Some of these varieties become politically powerful, and then they're singled out as the language, right? And then everything else is like, okay, this is just, spoken, just used for spoken interaction and so on. The reality is that the only difference between some linguistic varieties that are seen as the language and others is political might. The only reason that those varieties are seen as the language and they're taught at school and so on is that they are politically, financially, historically powerful. Mm. And so one thing to remember is that especially as technology begins to really kind of take center stage is, are the technologies that are available to people kind of like reflecting that unequal sort of privileged position of some varieties over others? And the reality is that yes, mm-hmm. yes, this is happening. And so this is something that Language Lab, not the radio segment, but my lab at UWA has begun to work on in collaboration with Google. And I think we'll have several episodes about this in due course. But I wanted to say that next week, mm-hmm. we're actually doing a segment on Christmas carols.
Excellent. Excellent.
And that'll be your last episode for 23, so very much looking forward to it.
Indeed. Dr. Celeste Rodriguez-Lura, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Pleasure.
Celeste is the Chair of Linguistics and Director of Language Lab at UWA, and we'll talk Christmas carols next Thursday.